You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Thursday, July 29th, 2021. My name is Emma Vigeland, in for Sam Steeder, and this is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Martin Sherwin, author of Gambling with Armageddon, Nuclear Roulette from Hiroshima to the Cuban Missile Crisis. Meanwhile, in a 67-32 vote, the Senate has voted to take up the $1 trillion bipartisan infrastructure package, passing a significant hurdle. However, at the same time, Kyrsten Sinema publicly toys with not voting for the much larger reconciliation package, which is tied to this bill's passage. What a joy that she is. The U.S. economy grew by 6.5% in GDP in the period between April and June, according to the Commerce Department, and it's a wait and see, though, on how this Delta variant will hamper that growth. I think it will. Meanwhile, the Olympics continue to barrel forward as Tokyo reports record COVID cases for the third straight day. President Biden has called on Congress to extend the eviction moratorium, which ends in a few days. A few weeks ago, the Supreme Court upheld the moratorium, but said Congress would have to be responsible for extending it past the July 31st deadline. In Peru, socialist Pedro Castillo was sworn in as president yesterday, marking a massive victory for leftist politics in the region. And lastly, Republican Congressman Mo Brooks, who is facing legal issues after the insurrection that he keeps downplaying, revealed to a Slate reporter that he wore body armor for that peaceful protest he spoke at on January 6th. Curious. All this and more on today's program. Welcome to the show, ladies and gentlemen. Sam is out today, as he is on Thursdays these days, but I am in. I am here with Matt and Bradley, and we've got a great show for you today. I'm very much enjoying how I get to dive deep with historians on days where I'm hosting kind of solo on topics that I really am fascinated by, and the proliferation of nuclear weapons, which is sometimes something that we take for granted as something that needs to exist in our society, because we've been alive when nuclear weapons haven't existed.
And we almost didn't make it this far.
Right. That's the subject of the interview today, and the book is how close we came to total nuclear annihilation, because this is the road that we decided to go down as a people. But on that lovely note, let's turn to Nancy Pelosi. Yesterday, Nancy Pelosi answered some questions on Joe Biden's refusal to cancel student loan debt.
Joe Biden. I said Biden.
Biden?
I haven't heard that one, but Joe Biden.
Joe Biden.
I was calling him Joe Bidet earlier, but yeah.
Well, I mean, for Hello Tushy purposes. Joe Biden. Joe Biden's refusal to cancel student loan debt. So she answered a press pool question about it. She's contradicting her claims by her counterpart in the Senate, because Chuck Schumer is ostensibly at least trying to get Biden to cancel $50,000 of student loan debt in tandem with Elizabeth Warren. Who knows how performative that is? But honestly, Biden hasn't budged at all. And this is a political layup for him if he chooses to take the shot. Seemingly, he's just trying to just sit at half court with the ball in his hands. And that hurts people, because there are 44 million Americans who have over $1.6 trillion of student loan debt. But here is Nancy Pelosi providing cover for the Biden administration. We have two clips for you. Here's the first.
People think that the president of the United States has the power for debt forgiveness. He does not. He can postpone. He can delay. But he does not have that power. That has to be an act of Congress. And I don't even like to call it forgiveness, because that implies a transgression. It's not to be forgiven. Just freeing people from those obligations. The question of who gets forgiven, to use the term of art that is out there, is a debate. Do we use whatever money there is for the broadest base of support of those with more people with even less debt, or fewer people with more debt? That's a policy discussion. But the difference between the president can't do it. So that's not even a discussion. Not everybody realizes that. But the president can only postpone, delay, but not forgive.
So that's just not accurate, right?
College, but you're paying.
That's just not accurate, right? So the American Prospect has done great reporting on this subject. As I mentioned, over 40 million Americans have student debt right now. It's an albatross on the neck of the economy. People keep saying, oh, we need to get young people and millennials more incentivized to buy homes, as if there's any money available to them. What would give them money is if some of this student debt was canceled, or not all of it. That's what I'm in favor. But at the very least, this $50,000 figure that is being proposed by Chuck Schumer and Elizabeth Warren in the Senate. And it's not true that he doesn't have the authority to do this. Biden, during the pandemic, essentially opted out of collecting student debt, since after the Obama era, the government has been the primarily responsible for all of the student debt owed. Obama got rid of banks as the middlemen in 2010, and it essentially made student loans kind of public properties for the government. So by that exact same legal authority, Biden can eliminate debt. And Biden was supposed to be getting together this kind of legal task force to figure out that very question that David Dayen and the American Prospect already figured out. But the reality is that it was a stalling tactic, and Pelosi just kind of jumped the gun on giving cover for the Biden administration, because they were going to say this anyway. It's completely disgusting, but she didn't stop there. She continued and decided to adopt a libertarian light argument to run cover again for the Biden administration.
This is how you know she's lying, because if it was just about Biden didn't have the ability to do this, she wouldn't say, and also it would be unfair to these in this really dumb way she's about to say here.
Right, exactly.
That would be an attitude that people would have. But even take it on top of that, suppose your family was not, your child just decided they want to, at this time, not want to go to college, but you're paying taxes to forgive somebody else's obligations, you may not be happy about that. But you know what? We want all of our kids to reach their fulfillment. To the extent that they want to go to college, we do not want them to be prohibited from doing that for financial reasons. I've had high school students come in here and say with their group.
So her argument there essentially is that people shouldn't be paying taxes to provide for the general welfare of people when those taxes don't directly benefit them. I think I've heard that argument a few times from right-wingers, from libertarians, and I didn't realize that it was an argument that held water in her mind, that if I don't want my taxes to go towards drone strikes on children, if I don't want my taxes to go towards funding ICE, if I want to stop funding oil and gas subsidies, that I get to just like opt out. And that's something that she sees as perfectly reasonable in her kind of politics. But like, this is the road that she wants to go down. This is exactly to Matt's point. She panicked at this moment because this kind of philosophy contradicts everything that even Democrats like her are supposed to espouse. The reality is that she's gotten the memo down from the Biden administration that they're not going to do this. And she went a little too far in her answer there. And that this is a source of revenue for the government. when that middleman was cut out and when the government became the primary holders of debt in the United States, they make money from this, one. And two, Biden has always seen debt as a way to discipline people. This comes from his time as a senator and his history with credit card companies. He wants student debt really to be an albatross in a way for generations of people to keep working in industries that make a ton of money, to say not going into social work, for example, or being a public defender. This is a way to funnel people into corporate America, one, and two, it's a disciplinary tool as debt, and three, it's a revenue source for the federal government. So Biden does not want to touch this at all, and he's making up some legal jargon and process. As I return to, the theme of the Biden administration is hiding behind procedure and legal obstacles that don't exist in many instances to not do what's right.
Well, and obstacles that Schumer and Elizabeth Warren have said don't exist. So the fight needs to be heightened between those camps.
Right. And that is on them, Schumer and Elizabeth Warren, right now, to have a response that's forceful and contradicts Nancy Pelosi. Part of what Pelosi's calculating here, too, is that they're not going to do that. It looks bad if there's a public fight between the Senate Majority Leader of the Democratic Party and the Speaker of the House of the Democratic Party. And so this is why she's kind of she's being a barrier between the two rowdy senators.
Yeah, if you're in Schumer or Warren's office, it's time to look bad. It's time to start looking bad about this stuff.
Agreed. Because just for self-preservation purposes, constantly I feel like I have to appeal to the Democratic Party's desire to remain in power. But this is a pretty good damn way to remain in power, to cancel people's student debt. People aren't going to forget that.
And we've done, the gradients of Biden. As far as, the structural stuff, I still think he's basically on an F, a D, basically. We keep hearing these talks of this might get done, this that might get done, and I'm sorry, big spending, unless you get these structural things, it's not that. And I don't know,
unless
you get Schumer and Warren on side for student loan debt, and then they get played off by procedural things, that's a party problem.
Right. You can't. Right, exactly. I mean, I would give him a C because I think the child tax credit's an important thing and universal pre-K, but absolutely, if the Senate Majority Leader is going to allow an argument, a flimsy and untruthful argument about procedure to get in the way of something that's necessary like this, okay, that is a Democratic Party problem, as you say. We're going to take a quick break. Sam has some ads. Samuel Cedar, coming to you from the past, or maybe from the future, has a word from our sponsors.
Today's sponsor is BetterHelp Online Counseling. They're giving our audience 10% off their first month when you go to betterhelp.com/majority report. BetterHelp gives you access to your own fully licensed and accredited therapist via phone, chat, or video. Now, sure you're aware, if you've attempted to go see a therapist, therapists elsewhere have long wait lists. Sometimes it can take you weeks. Sometimes it can take you months before they can see you. But when you sign up with BetterHelp, they match you with a therapist based on your specific needs, and you'll be communicating with them in less than 24 hours. A lot of people found telemedicine to be very helpful, particularly therapy during COVID. And I suspect there's a lot of folks who are just going to stick with that. I found it much more convenient. Obviously, a lot of stress coming out of a pandemic, a lot of stress during a pandemic, a lot of stress when there's not a pandemic. Therapy has been extremely helpful for me. It's always helpful to speak to someone. And once BetterHelp connects you with a therapist, if you find that it's not a good fit, you can switch to a new one at any time for any reason with no additional charge. They have thousands of licensed therapists from all over the country, so they have therapists with specialties that may not even be available in your area. BetterHelp also tends to be more affordable than therapists that you'd find through traditional means. You don't have to have insurance to use BetterHelp, and they have financial aid options for those who qualify. BetterHelp is giving everyone in our audience 10% off your first month when you go to BetterHelp.com/majority report. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P, BetterHelp.com/majority report. You can find the URL in the description of this video or podcast, and check it out.
I would like to welcome to the program Martin Sherwin. He is the author of Gambling with Armageddon, Nuclear Roulette, from Hiroshima to the Cuban Missile Crisis. Welcome to the show, Martin.
Thank you very much, Emma. Glad to be here.
Yeah, so I'm really excited to talk about your book because it really starkly lays out how close that we actually came to the use of nuclear weapons in the Cuban Missile Crisis. And the first chapter of your book is entitled World War III Was About to Begin. So let's start there. I guess tell the stories of, you know, Kennedy, Khrushchev, their Castro's preparations. It seemed like they were kind of running around with like chickens with their heads cut off, even though they're portrayed a bit more stoically in more traditional historical texts. But there literally was an order given to a Soviet captain to arm a nuclear torpedo aimed at U.S. vessels. So that's insane and scary. Talk about that.
Well, one of the themes of Gambling with Armageddon is the role of luck. And I begin at the end of the crisis on the very last day, October, well, the day before the crisis ended, Saturday, October 27th, when there were four Soviet submarines in the blockade area. And those submarines had been identified by the American anti-submarine warfare forces, the destroyers, the ASW planes, et cetera. And the destroyers were dropping depth charges on one of the submarines. It happened to be B-59. And the captain of that submarine was convinced that those depth charges were meant to destroy his submarine. He figured the war had begun. Now, these were conventional powered submarines, so they needed their batteries charged and that sort of thing. And this submarine was running out of electrical power. And the captain panicked, and he said, "We will not be the disgrace of the Soviet Navy. We will die, but we will take them with us." The submarine had a nuclear torpedo on board, which the United States did not know that these submarines carried a nuclear torpedo. And he gave the order to load it and take out the aircraft carrier that was in the area. Now, that's 4,000 or 5,000 U.S. Sailors on that aircraft carrier. At the last minute, an officer named Arkhipov, who was of equal rank of the captain, decided that given the situation as he analyzed it, the destroyers were not trying to sink the submarine. It was trying to warn the submarine that it had to come up to the surface. And he managed to talk the captain out of firing that nuclear torpedo. So we came close within minutes. And there are two issues involved here. One, we were very lucky that Arkhipov was aboard that submarine. Had it been somebody who didn't have such a cool head, the nuclear torpedo may have been fired. So despite what Kennedy and Khrushchev were doing at that point to try to end the crisis peacefully, they were both desperately trying to avoid nuclear war, but they had no control over what was going on under the sea in the Caribbean, several miles off the coast of Cuba. So, you know, the idea of the White House or Moscow having control of crises is brought into question. There is one thing that the leaders want to do, and there's another thing sometimes that's going on out in the field, so to speak.
Right. Well, I mean, there's such a an arrogance to believing that one could wrestle human beings and just natural circumstances in order to hold on to these weapons of mass destruction in ways that are, controllable on a level that is justifiable in their existence. I guess I want to back up a little bit then to World War II to talk about the creation of these weapons and emphasize the death and the untold suffering that they're caused. We can talk about Hiroshima and Nagasaki in 1945 when the nuclear age began. And as you write, the atomic bomb became a symbol of American supremacy. Take us to that point in history.
Yes. Well, you know, one of the important historical points that needs to be emphasized, as you did by bringing us back to Hiroshima, is the fact that these weapons were created during World War II. And more importantly, they were used at the end of World War II. And they were used, legitimizing those weapons as weapons of war. And that's the context in which the Cold War begins. The United States has a monopoly on this new, incredibly dangerous force, nuclear weapons. And the Soviet Union is desperately trying to catch up between 1945 and 1949. And the Soviet Union does catch up in August of 49 when it manages to test successfully a nuclear weapon. And the nuclear arms race is essentially off and running. And one of the other points that I emphasize in Gambling with Armageddon, and it's the reason it's called subtitle From Hiroshima to the Cuban Missile Crisis, is that you can't think, in my opinion, you can't think of the Cuban Missile Crisis or any of the crises that came after 1945 as something that comes out of space suddenly. Everything is connected and follows from Hiroshima and the validation of those weapons as weapons of war. History would have been very different if the United States had refused to use those weapons and argued publicly that these are weapons that are beyond the pale. They're uncivilized. We'd never use them if we weren't forced to, and they shouldn't exist. And if that had been the American stance, as opposed to these are great weapons that give us an advantage, history would have been sort of different and a lot less dangerous. In any case, we are living with the consequences of Hiroshima, and those consequences were built upon most vigorously by President Eisenhower. During the Eisenhower administration, the president adopted the idea of massive retaliation, that nuclear weapons should be in the forefront of American foreign and military policy. And it was Eisenhower who created the world that we have lived in ever since. The nuclear world that we've lived in ever since, with nuclear weapons at the center of American foreign and military policy. And it's, as you point out, extremely dangerous. You know, before the nuclear age, if a nation made a bad decision about war and peace, terrible things happened, like World War II. 50 millions, tens of millions of people dying. But in the nuclear age, you make the same mistake. You're not talking about tens of thousands or millions of people dying. You're talking about the possibility of the end of human civilization. So we're living in a different world in terms of consequences, but we are living with the same mentality of the pre-nuclear age. That combination is incredibly dangerous.
Absolutely. I'm curious why you credit Eisenhower for this current world and not Truman, who, you know, made the decision to drop the bombs in the first place.
Yes. Well, credit, I wouldn't use the term credit. But, well, I mean, clearly the decision to use nuclear weapons was the trigger, so to speak, that began the nuclear age. But the difference between Truman's nuclear policy and Eisenhower's nuclear policy was significant. After Hiroshima, and in the remaining time during his presidency, his reelection in 1948, Truman always maintained very tight control over nuclear weapons. And he thought of nuclear weapons as a backstop, a backup. When Eisenhower came into office, he reversed that. Nuclear weapons were not going to be a backstop. They were going to be in the forefront. They were going to be the substitute for conventional American weapons, because it was, and the phrase was developed during this time, more bang for the buck. It was the cheaper way of promoting American power around the world. And it was that presentation of nuclear weapons as the mainstay of American policy that became the blueprint for Khrushchev's policy also. I mean, he looked at this and said, you know, nuclear weapons are being, we, the Soviet Union, are being threatened by John Foster Dulles, the Secretary of State, who was Eisenhower's mouthpiece, you know, constantly. Well, we can do the same thing. Remember, after August 49, the Soviet Union had nuclear weapons. And so the kind of threatening with nuclear weapons that went back and forth between the United States and the Soviet Union during the 1950s created the framework that led to the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Well, then let's move towards the Eisenhower era, right? Eisenhower infamously began training people in Guatemala, I believe, with, alongside the CIA, which set the stage for the Bay of Pigs. And I guess if you could talk about that a bit, and also his the larger context of his foreign policy as related to nuclear weapons?
Well, Eisenhower was a rabid anti-communist, much more emotionally committed to that than he let on in public. We know this from his diaries. Even as early as 1946, he wrote something to the effect in his diary that we are engaged in a fight to the death with communism and, you know, and so on and so forth. That was 1946. I mean, you know, the Cold War hadn't yet begin to dominate everything in the way it did. Anyway, Eisenhower comes in, reverses the role of nuclear weapons from the Truman administration, develops the idea of massive retaliation, and brinksmanship, and engages in a whole series of anti-communist activities. And it's more than anti-communist activities. The overthrow of Mossadegh in Iran, the overthrow of in Guatemala of Arbenz, CIA operations. All of this was promoted as the foundation of American, you know, foreign policy. So we have nuclear weapons sort of for, let's call it the mega issues dealing with the Soviets. And we have the CIA overthrowing actually reformist governments, not communist governments, but even reformist governments were intolerable to Eisenhower. And so this really leads us to the Bay of Pigs. When Castro takes over Cuba in January 1959, Eisenhower comes to believe that Castro is going to be a problem, that he, like Arbenz and Mossadegh, is a reformer. Reformers are communists. We got to get rid of him. And he authorizes the CIA to organize a group of anti-Castro Cubans to invade Cuba and get rid of Castro. Now, this happens at the end of the Eisenhower administration. Kennedy is elected, and he inherits, in effect, this operation. And Kennedy had painted himself into a corner, because he had campaigned actually to the right of Richard Nixon, arguing that the Eisenhower administration, in which Richard Nixon was the vice president, had done little to get rid of this communist Castro. Campaign rhetoric, nonsense. Once he became president, he decided there was no way that he could reject the Bay of Pigs arrangements that had been made, given how he had campaigned. But he was, you know, very, very concerned that this invasion was not going to be a very good idea. And he made it very clear. Very clear to the CIA that if the invaders fail in their efforts to overthrow Castro, he, the president, is not going to authorize American military troops, Navy, Marines, Air Force, etc., to come in and support them, which is what the CIA assumed any president would have to do, no matter what he said. So, the invasion takes place. It's a total failure. The CIA expects the president to reverse himself, and Kennedy does not reverse himself. And we have this failed Bay of Pigs. That provides the framework for the Cuban Missile Crisis. And it's absolutely important to understand that, because had it not been for the Bay of Pigs, there probably would have been no Cuban Missile Crisis. Why? Because Castro and Khrushchev believed that this humiliation that the United States faced, this failure of the Bay of Pigs invasion, was going to be rectified, so to speak, by the United States by an invasion. Some excuse would be found for the United States military forces to invade Cuba. So Khrushchev now has a problem. His new best friend is Fidel Castro. And it becomes important to the Soviet Union to protect Castro, because if he fails to protect Castro, the view is that, well, the Soviet Union talks a good game, but it really doesn't protect its friends. And so Khrushchev said, how can I protect Castro 90 miles from the United States when I'm 2,000 miles from the United States or something like that? And he gets this idea. I'm going to do what Eisenhower did. Eisenhower sent intermediate range nuclear weapons to Turkey and to Italy in the late 1950s in order to provide the European nations, NATO, with nuclear security. Great idea. I'm going to do the same thing in Cuba. I'm going to sneak these weapons into Cuba. And when they're ready to fire, the United States wouldn't dare invade Cuba because I might fire these nuclear weapons at New York City or Washington. So that's the framework and the connections between Hiroshima, Eisenhower, Cuban Missile Crisis, Bay of Pigs, the whole thing comes together in October 1962, when a U-2 flight on October 14th flies over Cuba and takes pictures that on the next day indicate that intermediate nuclear weapons were being set up in Cuba.
Right. And I mean, then all hell breaks loose, essentially, right? It amazes me the degree to which human error is completely left out of the equation with the discussion and promulgation of these incredibly inhuman and destructive weapons. And, you know, you write about the chaos and how close things got so well. One of the things that stuck out to me was how, you know, XCOM, this advisory council that was assembled to provide advice for Kennedy during this crisis. There's, as I say, been like a lot of lofty revisionist history about what that provided. But everyone was largely in the dark. And you talked about that briefly. That's part of what pushed us to the brink here. Just talk about that a bit.
Okay. There are actually many Cuban Missile Crises. Every nation that was participating in the United Nations at the time, had its own sort of crisis of sorts. But there were two main crises. There's the United States and the Soviet Union and Cuba, which I'm putting together. As I mentioned, the U-2 that flew over Cuba on October 14th and took photographs of the intermediate range and medium range nuclear weapons that were being constructed there, that initiated the Cuban Missile Crisis in the United States. The Soviet Union did not know, nor did Cuba, that we had discovered those missiles. So for a week, from October 16th, the morning of October 16th, a Tuesday, when Kennedy was informed that these missiles were in Cuba, from that point until October 22nd in the evening, when Kennedy gave the public speech on television and radio announcing the blockade of Cuba, that was the United States' phase one, I'll call it, Cuban Missile Crisis, when Kennedy and his advisors were deciding, what are we going to do? These weapons are in Cuba. We got to get rid of them, they decided. Why? Are they dangerous? No. Are they going to change the balance of power? No. McNamara says it's not an issue of security. It's a political issue. After the Bay of Pigs, if Kennedy allowed, this was their judgment, if Kennedy allowed the missiles to stay in Cuba, his chance for reelection was probably less than zero. So it's this political issue. Now, how do we get rid of the weapons? Most of the advisors are arguing, and all of the Joint Chiefs are arguing, that we need to bomb and invade. Kennedy goes along with that on the first day. He happens, and this is another element of luck, to have a prearranged luncheon with Adlai Stevenson, the American ambassador to the United Nations, who, when he is told by Kennedy about the discovery of these weapons, says to the president, no, bombing an invasion is a very bad idea, and this can be solved diplomatically. And we know exactly, more or less exactly, what he told the president on October 16th after lunch, because the next day he writes a memorandum summarizing their conversation. So over the next, one of the fascinating things that, at least what I find fascinating in studying this and writing it up, was the watching Kennedy slowly change his mind about invasion and bombing. It's fascinating to see this president's mind at work. And we can talk about seeing his mind at work because we have a unique source. About, well, several months before, the president had a secret recording system placed in the cabinet room and the Oval Office. And during all of these meetings with his advisors, he switched on the tape recording system. So we know exactly what the president said, what McNamara said, what Rusk said, and so on and so forth. There were about 14 advisors. And we watched the president, this is the way I organized section on the Cuban Missile Crisis, focusing on how the president thought about the issues. And one of the most interesting things about his analysis was his constant questioning. And he was the only one who did this. His constant questioning. Why did Khrushchev do this? What does he have in mind? And it's interesting to see how Kennedy's mind works so differently from McNamara and Rusk and, you know, and the others.
Well, I have to ask about that. You know, I know probably lastly, McNamara, military officials around him, the fact that he was thinking so differently from them probably saved us from a lot of bloodshed, right?
It probably saved the world from a nuclear war.
Exactly. Well, I was downplaying it, but I appreciate it. Yeah, I mean, I'm curious about how often you came across military advisors and just people in the military calling for preemptive strikes during this time, because there were a lot of probably close calls, even more than the ones that you documented in this book.
Yes. One of the most interesting things to consider is where people came from, so to speak. What were their experiences? What shapes their view of the world? And the contrast between Kennedy, second lieutenant, naval officer during World War II, and General LeMay and General Wheeler and General Shoup and General Taylor, all of the Joint Chiefs who were senior officers during World War II, that provides one of the elements for analysis of why people thought the way they did. The Joint Chiefs unanimously consistently wanted to invade and bomb Cuba. And when Kennedy asked General LeMay, for example, the Air Force Chief of Staff, well, what are the Soviets going to do when we kill a lot of their troops and we bomb Cuba and all of that? LeMay says, they're not going to do anything. And Kennedy says, oh, really? Why? Well, he said, because, they know we're going to wipe them out if they do something. And Kennedy has a totally different view. On October 19th, Friday before his speech, he meets with the Joint Chiefs. And he says, let me explain my point of view. Excuse me. If we invade Cuba, this will give Khrushchev the opportunity or the excuse to invade West Berlin and kick us and try to kick us out of there. If they do that, I'm going to have to use nuclear weapons. If I use nuclear weapons, the Soviets are going to respond with nuclear weapons. We're going to have a nuclear war. That doesn't make much sense. And there are these two different views. Kennedy is thinking globally and thinking about the relationship with our NATO allies and how important that is and how that obligates us in ways that could lead to a disaster if we make the wrong decision. And the Joint Chiefs are just saying, look, this is a good excuse to get rid of Castro. Let's invade. The Soviets aren't going to do anything. They wouldn't dare. Well, what kind of guarantees do we have of that? All policy decisions, in fact, all our decisions in life are based on assumptions. And those assumptions are the product, usually, of our experience and how we see the world. And again, one of the most fascinating things about this story is the difference between how Kennedy sees the world and how the Joint Chiefs see the world and how Kennedy's advisors see the world. And fortunately, in the end, both Kennedy and Khrushchev saw the world in the same way. That is to say, they wanted to do everything to keep the world in one piece and not blow it up. And finally, on Sunday, October 28th, Khrushchev, who is panicked about losing control over his troops in Cuba, They, for example, on Saturday, the day before, while the submarine story was going on, unknown to them, a Soviet aircraft, surface-to-air crew shot down a U-2. Khrushchev hadn't authorized that. So by Sunday, he was quite panicked, and it's too complicated a story to tell at this point, but basically said, basta, we're going to settle this thing.
I mean, the amount of close calls are—it's incredible. We're very lucky. I appreciate your time, Martin Sherwin. He's the author of "Gambling with Armageddon: Nuclear Roulette from Hiroshima to the Cuban Missile Crisis," and you have a variety of books on this topic. I'd encourage people to check them out. Thank you so much, Martin, for your time today.
Thank you, Emma, for your time. I appreciate it. Thank you.
All right, we're going to take a quick break and be right back. That was such a great history lesson. I don't know how you felt, Matt, but
I think, you know, a lot of people know that Kennedy was a cold war hawk, particularly in the 1960 election to beat Nixon. But when you actually look at his record and what his advisors wanted him to do, for instance, at the Bay of Pigs or during the Cuban Missile Crisis, I think his legacy looks a little bit better. I mean, obviously, I have plenty of time to talk about all the things he did participate in, like continuing covert assassination attempts against like people like Castro and stuff like that. But you have to understand who else was in the room
right
at that point.
Right, right. That was the most illuminating part of that for me. But before we go, let's talk a little bit about the CDC. So Anthony Fauci was on MSNBC the other day addressing the fact that some weeks ago, the CDC said, do away with your masks. At the time, I thought that was silly.
And so did the National Nurses Unions.
Yep. And now he's having to explain why it wasn't silly. Let's hear what he had to say.
Something has changed, and what has changed is the virus. The CDC hasn't changed, and the CDC hasn't really flip-flopped at all. What's happened is that when that earlier recommendation was made, we were dealing predominantly with the Alpha variant.
Exactly, but that's the exact point. We knew that variants were coming. What the CDC was thinking was, and I don't agree with this thinking, but I'm going to say it to people because a lot of people who cover, you know, say an error that Fauci or the CDC make don't point out that they're overwhelmingly right and their guidance should be followed on almost everything because this is a pandemic and they're coming out with these public health measures on purpose. But there are points where, of course, they're not above criticism. They knew the Delta variant was coming, not in itself, but they knew that variants were coming, that it was going to become more transmissible. And that was the whole purpose behind the vaccine push, because we wanted to outpace the creation of the variants with the vaccine push. And so I don't even think this is helpful, right? We could say, you know, oh, at that time, we made an error, essentially, right? But to say, oh, we don't flip-flop, that's not necessarily true.
Well, I mean, to say the virus changed, like, the virus didn't start, like, having the ability to mutate, as he mentioned, they were already dealing with a variation of it already. And so we knew that this was a possibility, and that's why people like the nurses unions were like, hey, let's not do this just for, like, basically the nudge that it might give people who are skeptical of vaccines, right? Like,
which it didn't do,
it didn't,
right?
Do, yeah.
And we foresaw that this would be the case. They made a political calculation about this. They chose that they were going to use masks as a bit of a carrot to get people to get more vaccinated. And that's not what we saw. That's not what we saw at all. And now it's impossible to put the toothpaste back into the tube in many ways because people are already not wearing masks. And red states were going to run with this no matter what.
I think it's time for a new person to be making these sorts of statements than Fauci. I think Fauci should step down.
I agree. Fauci can, if he wants to have his role in the CDC in a different capacity, cool. Like, I mean, he certainly has the credentials. But in terms of a public face, they're literally selling "Don't Fauci My Florida" shirts in Florida. On DeSantis's website.
And it's always a political motivation. I don't know how much time we have left, but just quickly about the mask thing at the start of the pandemic, right? That was Fauci trying to preserve stock and not actually, like, and we muddled mask science from the beginning there.
Yeah. And so the point is that he's been politicized in many ways against his will, but then the CDC has also made political calculations and he's become a political figure. So we appreciate a lot of his work. Maybe time for a new face. But that's all the time we have today. And thank you so much for tuning in, Peacock audience. We will see you with Sam for Casual Friday tomorrow.
And actually, we might need to go look at Sam right now because I accidentally put up the wrong ad. I had them labeled wrong. So we need to play a BetterHelp ad.
Okay. Well, hello, Sam. Good to see you.
Yep. Here goes Sam. We're back.
We are back. Thank you so much, Sam, for that beautiful advertisement. Matt, how you doing, man?
I'm doing good, Emma. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. I'm doing well, and I also have correct grammar. What's happening over on Doomed?
Well, on Doomed, there's going to be a live show tonight at 9 p.m. Eastern time, and stay tuned to what's happening tonight. You know, things, plans sometimes change, as you know, but it'll be a great show for you all tonight, youtube.com/Matt Binder at 9 p.m. Eastern time. And I'll see you all then.
Nice. And now we're joined by Brandon Sutton. What's up, Brandon?
Hey, guys. You know, I am a little bit late. I was just watching the Majority Report with Sam Cedar. I don't know if you've heard of it. Oh. I got distracted.
Oh, gotcha.
But for me, actually, we haven't recorded this week. I'm sorry. Life got in the way. I was helping a friend move. So I'll keep you updated via Twitter.
Very nice.
The MR Thursday crew shows are really well planned, as you can see. We all have our stuff together. And
I have never said I have my stuff together. I'm an amateur.
Well, luckily, Left Reckoning is on Wednesdays now, so Whoa. We got our stuff together last night. We had Ben Spielberg on to talk about healthcare and Joe Biden's broken promises and how to deal with that, and also pressure the squad without labeling them fraud squad, and how that's actually an easier thing to do. But with all the acrimony, I think, and a heretic hunting on all sides, it's been a little bit difficult to figure out how to say no. To a lot of this stuff, but so check that out. Ben Spielberg last night. I also got into Chris Rufo, the CRT panic stoker, and his laundry boy Connor Friedersdorf, who works for the Atlantic. So check that out. We got into CRT in depth. It's like a sort of, I mean, basically it's a red panic. I mean, these guys call it Marxist all the time. It's not Marxist, but you know what it does do is inform people as to why certain hierarchies might not be natural and might be, you know, a result of policy. So anyway, last night, Left Reckoning, patreon.com/Left Reckoning, did the post game where I talk about a 10-year-old article I wrote when I had just read Marx for the first time. And you can see that it influenced me. So check that out. patreon.com/Left Reckoning, which actually that I'm going on a lot, but our post game video got taken down because we were discussing Will Witt's pandemic conspiracy, and I don't want to say anything more than that because you get strikes for doing things like that. But Will Witt, Prager, you guy had a bad theory about capitalism in China and this virus, and we got that taken down. So if you want to hear it, patreon.com/leftreckoning.
All right, that sounds good. We will head into the fun half now, 646-257-3920. See you there.
You are in for it.
All right, folks, 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.
Oh, no.
Are you ready?
Oh, yeah. Who sent us this?
Anarchy. Alpha males are back, boy is back, and the alpha males are back.
Just as delicious as you could imagine.
The alpha males are back, boy is back, and the alpha males are back.
Just wanna degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back.
I take all of it to my throat.
Alpha males are back.
Snowflake says what?
The alpha males are back.
You are a madman!
And the alpha males are back.
Oh no, Sam Cedar, what a fucking nightmare!
Yeah, or a couple of them, just put them in rotation.
DJ Danner.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough for the break.
That's fucking nonsense.
See white people doing drugs that look worse than normal white people, and all white people look disgusting.
And the alpha males,
psych, fuck them.
Snowflake says what?
What?
Snowflake says what?
A hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank. Okay. I'm making stupid money. A hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank.
All lives matter.
Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
And the alpha males are back. And the Africans are black African. And the alpha males are black. And the Africans are back.
When you see Donald Trump out there, doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keep it at 100. Can't knock the hustle.
Come on! Fuck them.
Things I do for the bigger game plan.
By the way, it's my birthday! Happy birthday to me, Jew boy!
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back. Africans are black. Alpha males are black. Africans are back.
Come on!
To pay the price for blasphemy around here.
I am a total pussy.